Thank you. I'm really grateful to be back with you. It was such a joy last time and so encouraging to me after the service to talk to many of you, as well as to bring you a message which largely had to do with my pilgrimage from being what I think of as probably, and probably arrogantly, as being well thought through as Christian apologist. My doctoral project is in church growth. I read Greek and Hebrew. To becoming an atheist, basically, but one who was for something, one who knew there was something to be for rather than just to be against a God concept. The change just about killed me, literally, physically killed me. I became quite chemically dependent during one period of my life, from which I now have years of recovery, for which I'm grateful. But this message is sort of a corollary in the sense that it talks about how one can face change. So with that sort of remembrance for those who were with us before and new information for those who are with us for the first time today as I speak, you'll understand the context for this story about how to really enjoy change, which was very difficult for me to enjoy for a while. It began, as far as I'm consciously aware, in 1966. I'm 50, so I was 12. My sister was 14 and a half, and she was really into this group called the Beatles. I remember going to Zodi's in Covina and buying a wig. They had these wigs you could buy that looked like what my mom would have described as using a bowl to cut a hair, you know, a ring around one's head. But I was all into that. I think today I'd be grateful to be able to buy one of those wigs. My favorite group, my truth is that Metallica is the greatest band who ever lived, were toddlers. The ones that are older in Metallica were toddlers during that time. But I remember as what I would now consciously call being nominally Christian, I remember offering this prayer, and pretty much this was the language. Oh my God, don't let me get stuck not being able to change like I see, and basically it was the adult community. What the heck are they doing? It's like, I use the term, they're getting weirded out over bell bottoms and mini skirts and what seemed to me rather superficial things like hair length and mutton chops, you know, and that kind of thing. It was very perplexing to me, something that I literally prayed not to have occur in my life, anticipating that as I got older, it looked to me like everybody was getting stuck, not being able to change as they chronologically matured. And that prayer didn't really have much fruit in my life for many, many years. As you know, that pilgrimage, I was stuck in one worldview for quite a few years. But I believe, even as an atheist today, a secular humanist, the prayer, as in psychological language, my experiencing self and my observing self were communicating, it did have fruit. Because for whatever reason, obviously, I was able to press on through some gargantuan, angst-filled, not just weeks or months, but years, trying to change. We all recognize that the rate of change is rapidly escalating. It's exponential, the rate itself of change. So it's not true that the only thing constant is change. Change itself is changing in rate. I never would have thought at 12 I would say this, but when I was a kid, you know, computers existed, but they were the minimum refrigerator sized. For my parents, it would have been the size of large garages. I never would have anticipated that such a thing as Atari would come out with a game called Pong, or that by the time that my children were my age then, which is now a few years ago, they'd be able to play these handheld things and have graphics unimaginable. My dad, because of the work he did, exposed me to many different races, and many of them were very gracious, but I and my family and everyone I knew was racist to some degree. There was bias and prejudice. I'm sure it's not completely exonerated in my own life, and I think racism exists in quadrants today, but you never would have convinced me it would be such a lesser intensity and lesser in frequency experience as change has taken place in this culture. You know, since the 1966, which is the year that I offered that prayer, there has been a massive paradigm shift in Western culture, and we're kind of taking the lead for the rest of the world, as I can tell, best I can tell. So one of the main things to think about is what world we live in, and from a postmodern way of looking at the world, we would say, well, there isn't just one world. Because of the way you base your epistemology, how you know what you know, there are many different worlds we experience based on language and culture and myth and narrative and folklore and initiatory rites. for the first time in my life, and I'm pretty joyful about it with a little bit of angst. I have a grandchild, two of them. One's 6 months and one is 2 months. In what world will my granddaughter and my grandson and their great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren live? The one thing I know is it's going to be nothing remotely similar to the world in which I live. How do we face change like that and not just do it, but enjoy or thrive in the process? One of the things we know from the field of psychology and spirituality, which is the way I see my life today, is wedding those two things together, is it requires an ability to first recognize paradigm shifts and then be able to take new information and put it into the new paradigm as compared with where one doesn't face change well, using old paradigms and keep perniciously and persistently trying to shove the new information into an old paradigm. It just doesn't work. Consider the Amish family who went to the mall for the very first time. And as the family kind of wandered starry-eyed through the mall, Dad sort of got stuck in front of this box that had these images on it, and he was just watching with amazement the television set. And Mother and Junior sort of wandered off and went down the hallways until they came up on this part of a wall that was really shiny. I mean, really shiny. It stood out. And pretty soon the shiny wall separated somewhat like they remembered from their stories in the Old Testament of the Red Sea separating. And there was what looked like sort of a room. There was no windows, there was no doors, and there was an older gentleman with a cane that sort of came up to this place on the wall, and he went into the little room and he turned around and just stood there and looked at them. And they watched, and the shiny walls closed back together, and there was whirling sounds and there was lights flashing, and about 60 seconds later, the shiny wall pulled back open, and Mom's jaw dropped because out walked this 22-year-old strapping, studly guy with some roses in his hand. And she looked at the man, and she looked at the Junior, and she said, "Junior, go get your dad. I've got a deal I want to cut." If you take new information, but the only paradigm you've got is outdated, not functional, we might say, in postmodern terms. Not the story one might prefer in postmodern terms. You won't be able to change well. But when we make that shift, we can. So this first main point is to trust that you will thrive like billions, literally hundreds of billions of persons, consciousnesses, souls, psyches in Greek, or psyches have before you. But we've got 6 or 7 billion people alive right now. So just in 12,000 years of human history, forget about pre-human consciousness, by sheer reason alone, there must have been at least 200-300 billion people who have thrived or survived at least through gargantuan change. So it's not an issue of faith so much as it is pure reason to say, I'll do all right. I mean, can you imagine what it was like to shift from a nomadic culture to agricultural, or from agricultural to industrial, or as many observers of culture today are saying, to go from 2nd century BC to a 3rd century AD and be confronted with a Christocentric worldview that literally did shake the world upside down, or to be Christocentric in one's worldview and to be in the 1600s and go through the Enlightenment and eventually have your whole worldview supplanted by rationalism or scientism. These things are huge paradigm shifts, but literally hundreds of billions of people have done just fine transitioning that time, and we will too, if we trust that we will, like they, survive or thrive. The first sub-point is to recognize that our human psyche is programmed, to use a metaphor, a postmodern term, programmed to thrive or survive through incredible threats. And by incredible, I use my words very intentionally. I mean incredible, not credible, not able for the consciousness to even fathom how in the world I would be able to survive this thing. There used to be a disorder that we called multiple personality disorders. The new DSM-IV, which is the Bible of therapy, calls them dissociative identity disorders. It's not always trackable back to, but almost universally, is some abuse that is so horrific, so unacceptable to the consciousness of what we call this person, that they literally create an entire new identity or disassociate from the prior unified identity to cope. Which in one way, wow, that's pretty sad. But if you look at it from a different point of view, it's quite amazing. The psyche has some level of consciousness even prior to us being conscious of it, that the threat is too intense, too horrific. And it wants the organism to survive, so it will make sure that we do survive. And there's a lot of peace to be had in simply knowing that's the way that the psyche works. To poke a little fun at the way that we don't do that well, I would tell you about the guy whose anxiety about smoking was rising daily. And over a period of weeks, it got more and more intense. And finally, one morning, he woke up and he opened the newspaper, and there's the headline that said, "Cigarette smoking linked to additional health hazards." So his blood pressure came up a little bit, and he got a little nervous, but he went on to work. And as he's driving the car, he looks over to the side, and there's a placard on the bus, and it shows a woman sitting on a park bench smoking with her foot in a coffin on the ground. And he got a little more nervous, but he kept pressing on as he smoked on his way to work. And when he got to work, he thought, I'll have some coffee. And he goes in the break room, and there's a placard on the wall that says, "Stop Smoking Clinic, sponsored by your EAP. So he sort of shook that one off, and he went to his workstation and booted up the PC, and here's a pop-up window that says 50% off trans-nicoderm patches. So he'd had enough. You know, I'm done. I can't take this anxiety anymore. So the tension was so extreme that he just stopped. I mean, literally, that's it. And it's been a few years now. He's not even read his milk carton. Now, what's ludicrous about that is that we know people wouldn't stop reading. But do you know that in almost every one of our experience, we've done that at some point? Here's the potential for change. Yeah, I know I should change, but I don't want to. And the threat, we don't deal well with anxiety. So we'll reduce the anxiety one way or another. So we'll usually block out information. Hopefully we don't block out the wrong information. And that bridges me to subpoint number two, that your psyche or soul or self will allow in only that which your faith, your trust or confidence in your worship object allows you to have in your consciousness. Your psyche will allow in only that which you perceive at some level is information that I can tolerate, assimilate, or even maybe will help me thrive even more in life. We tend to be overly confident in our objectivity. Especially UUs, I think. And I've been, you know, a part of the UU movement for many, many years now. I think we tend to think that we're quite rational and we're quite objective, and we understand there's more than one way of looking at things, but we're fairly convinced that what we know to be true is really well thought through and pretty objective, pretty independent of any bias or subjectivity. But every study that's ever been done on human experiencing and how we know what we know says we do have some filters that block out information, and we tend to welcome at some level the information that confirms especially our cherished beliefs. And if something becomes sort of disconfirming to a cherished belief, we have a tendency to sort of overlook it. It's like we didn't see it at all. So we're not as objective as we often think ourselves to be. Which means that us knowing that also allows us to use that same computer metaphor to widen the information processing, to allow more info bits to come in, to put on some software that doesn't screen out quite so many what we might perceive to be viruses, so that we can have more information on our hard drive and be able to really flourish and grow. How we deal with change has a lot to do then with this first main subpoint, your faith. If your faith is based on reason, and your reason says, you know, I will do very, very well with this potential change. I can trust my worship object. You'll do great with change. And that leads me then to this main point number two. We need to find a securing epistemology. And I understand that you use come from many different philosophical backgrounds. I don't mean anything condescending by this. Therefore, when I share with you what those two things mean, especially since we may have those that are seeking with us today and don't have the same philosophical, theological, or faith pilgrimage background that many of us do as you use. So by epistemology, I mean that sub-discipline of philosophy that is the study of the origin, the nature, the limits, the methods of human knowledge. You know, how do I know what I know? My favorite group, Metallica, came out with their most recent CD a few years ago. There's a cut on it called My World. And the lyric, for the most part, by James Hetfield, the lead singer, says, "Not only do I not know the answers, I don't even know what the question is." Well, people of faith, I don't think it's arrogant. I think I know what the question is. It's your epistemology. It's my epistemology. How do I know what I know? That question must be answered before any other question, before your theology, before your ethics, before how you experience self-esteem, before you relate to your family, before you decide between good and evil, to go back to the myth of Genesis 1 through 3, how one knows what one knows is the question that every human being must answer. So now let me shift a little bit back to the prior message that I brought to you and plead for some empathy for those who are conservatives in your experience, as was mine. Picture me at 28 with a doctor's degree in theology who's been convinced by everything within me and all of my teachers and instructors that what you know has been given you by God. And then to have some part of me say, but I don't believe there is one. You're stuck in a loop. You can't get out of it. You can't free yourself from your epistemology. So when my family come to me today, I understand and empathic for where they, and they are all quite conservative in their faith systems, very Christocentric. I understand where they're coming from. They're stuck. You can't choose a different epistemology if the epistemology that you choose, which is theism, itself tells you, don't you, the one thing you dare not do is let go of God. Don't you dare let go of God. God is the one who will answer everything for you. Well, what do you do if that's the very thing you're questioning? You're stuck. And it takes some outside force to be able to free you from that. So what you know can be called reason, and some people would argue that. No, it's Aristotelian logic, and what I believe is objectively verifiable. Many people today have shifted to what they call pragmatism, and they would say, well, my epistemology is what works. You know, what's true is what works, not just for me, but for others. The vast majority of the world, even in Eastern tradition, except for Buddhism, have a theistic worldview. And their either polytheistic or theistic worldview would point to something like for theism, to the Judeo-Christian Bible. If it's the Muslim community, they would point to the Quran or to the Bible as well, since they honor both, but the Quran more. If they are polytheists, they might go to the Upanishads. If they're panentheists, or what many people call New Age today, they would go to like the Book of Miracles. But some look outside to some external written record and say, well, that's how I know truth. But whatever one's epistemology, I would simply ask you today to consider how well postmodernism works for facing change. That, I believe, is the paradigm we're now experiencing, the shift from a modernist worldview in which there is a truth to a postmodern worldview, which basically says, well, reality is there, but it can't be experienced objectively. None of it. All reality becomes experienced as we language, they use language like a verb, as we language into our experience whatever reality is. But we'll never actually objectively put our hands on reality. So the postmodernist is quite different from the modernist in this way. The modernist would say reality exists and it's our job as human beings to label it, describe it, use it, respond to it. But the postmodernist would say, well, no, reality is more a part of our narrative, folklore, initiatory rites, by literally hundreds, multiple hundreds of generations. And that these narratives, folklores, initiatory rites, analogies, metaphors, images that pervade every corpuscle of our language system. That's the way that we cause our experience of reality. It's not at all objective. It's much more subjective. And here's wisdom, I think. When you use, or any other religious community that's liberal says to a conservative, well, you know, that's your truth, I have my truth, we speak nonsense to them because their epistemology is modern, not postmodern. Well, what? It's like the tilt of the head. What are you talking about? Your truth. There's only a truth. I mean, it's either true or not true. Well, of course, in postmodern terms, that's not true. Or that's, they would say, not a functional story. A better story would be able to say that, no, there are things that are true for one culture that are diametrically opposite for another culture, and both things can be true. Because there is no objective approachable truth, there is only subjectively languaged truth. Anyway, it's quite a profound consideration, but I think it's very powerful for us. So consider how it works for experiencing change. Some change comes before me, and I first have to ask myself, well, how do I know what I know about this potential change, and is it going to be good for my worship object or not, and will it move me ahead in my life or not? And if so, it's simply opting for a different story. It's simply saying, come on, Mike, isn't there more life to be found over here by making this personal change? I love what I do. It's being the clinical coordinator of Passageways is very, very thrilling. My 6-month review just occurred, and it was good for the most part, but there was one part where both of my supervisors said, well, we need you to look at, in effect, changing here. And 15 years ago, I would have been very threatened and, you know, a little defensive and things. I think my experience was, as far as I'm consciously aware, that, okay, where is the new excitement in this change? How can I be more useful to the universe by considering this change? Little story to lighten the mood and make my point. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson are camping. And in the middle of the night, Sherlock wakes up Dr. Watson, and he says, Watson, wake up and tell me what you observe. So he opens his eyes, and he says, well, I see billions of stars. He says, yes, Watson, but what does that tell you? So he's thinking, you know, Sherlock Holmes is laying here. He says, well, astrologically, I suppose it's teaching me that Saturn appears to be in Leo, and astronomically speaking, I suppose there must be millions upon millions of stars, and chronologically, I surmise that it must be something like 2:10 in the morning, and spiritually, I surmise that I must be a part of a grand and glorious cosmos of which I'm an infinitesimal part, and meteorologically, I would venture to say it's going to be clear today, tomorrow. I mean, Sherlock, maybe 76 degrees, something like that. Looking for approval to Sherlock, he says, why, what do you observe? He said, you fool, Watson, someone stole our tent. Postmodernism is sometimes accused of being too complicated. I think it's just the opposite. Western culture says you behead people, you beheaded that person and paraded their body on an overpass. What the heck's wrong with you? The postmodernist would recognize that culture fighting for its very life in a text that literally teaches step by step how to do that is simply using an old paradigm. And to recognize that, wow, that's a story that no longer functions, my friend. And in love, trying to help people see that their story is errant, is not functional, is no longer useful to humanity is one thing. But to stand there saying, well, you have your truth and I have my truth, makes no sense to the conservative. They just can't see it. So we use language like a verb. And we use things like narrating one's experience or languaging into one's experience a certain experience that we would like. The last major point looks long, but it's not. It's rather brief. And that is to acquire the 7 traits for facing change that have been found to be quite useful in enjoying the process, thriving through the process. So very, very briefly, the first is to face your change opportunity. And there's some intention for that word to be used as a verb and to sound like face. Study after study show that those who face personal, relational, vocational changes and do well have an attitude of trust or confidence that this will be a good experience for them and for their usefulness to whatever their worship object may be. Number two, hold the perspective that change equals an opportunity to be useful. Whether extremely conservative Christian or extremely conservative Muslim or extremely conservative Buddhist, if there is such a thing, people who have the view that what that thing, that reality that I worship, my reason for getting up in the morning is to make one more small incremental change so I can be more useful to it, to her, to him. And those people who thrive on change and are excited about life have found a bliss that says, my reason for existing is to change as a person, consciousness, in order to be more useful to my worship object. The third trait to be associated with experiencing change well is to goal set. Measurable and specific and attainable, reachable but challenging goals, ones that are tangible, that one can visualize being accomplished, is so closely associated with a passion for wanting to change and being able to make that change. The fourth trait is to pace appropriately. In my earlier life, I used to think of the cutting edge of wanting to change too rapidly. And so I put too much pressure on myself. And so there's a lot of pacing that needed to take place and a balance between, I've got to make this change, got to make this happen, be effective, be productive, which stereotypically is a male trait, but we now know is not just it's more culturally induced than it is some kind of heredity or biological drive. But today I have found I have the opposite concern, too lackadaisical. Oh, well, like I've got this book I keep talking about writing, Atheist Preacher. I'm about halfway through the first chapter. I've been working on it for 6 years. Oh, well, whatever. If I don't write it, somebody else will. I realize there's literally hundreds of millions of people dying, because their faith system isn't working. They don't know how to get out of it. And I got some answers, but, whatever. Well, that'll kill me. Because my consciousness knows I need to be the balance between the stress of being productive and the too lackadaisical. So pace appropriately, number four. And then number five, be solution oriented. People who change well have predetermined that their thirst for knowledge will help them be effective. So they're always sensitive, their antenna up to gain new information for the purpose of being able to provide solutions. They don't get into the paralysis of analysis. And then the sixth trait is to enlist the help of others and alternate resources. We who want to change and have that passion will look towards outside influences. And obviously, for many years, I didn't do that. I can remember going back to Claremont as a questioning theism, for that matter, already in my late 20s, trying to find answers, but not knowing how to even ask the question to my professors, who were already more liberal than I, and I thought they were just crazy. I thought what they believed would lead me to nihilism. I didn't realize there was another answer out there. But there's a way of enlisting the help of others that propels oneself ahead. When I was in my earliest recovery, I was in Riverside at a place called Whiteside Manor. And this is a number of years ago now, and we were allowed to walk to church someplace, and there was this UU church there on, in Riverside. And I thought, UU's, they're liberal Christians, which that's what I thought the whole denomination was. And there are liberal Christians within UU's, but I didn't realize they were more all-encompassing than that until I visited the first time. Brandon Lovely was speaking, and it was quite an experience. Changed my life. So looking outside myself was able to provide some answers I would have not otherwise come up with. And the last trait is to recognize that we're response-able. We're always able to respond, whatever the circumstance. And we have a tendency, a propensity to blame, in psychological language, to externalize the locus of control, that it's someone else's, it's some other institution's fault that this or that took place, rather than, no, I don't like this or that. How can I respond? Because I know I can. I'm able to respond. But let me conclude and pull this together with some, I think, slightly humorous examples of people who were pretty sure they knew some things, but what they knew was probably not all that functional, to use postmodern language, and therefore might have given them the clue to look to the possibility of personal change. These were purported, at least, to be actual school excuse notes written to teachers and administrators. The first one says, "Please excuse Lisa for being absent. She was sick, and I had her shot." I can see her brother saying, "No, Mom, I'm feeling great. I'm feeling great today." There's only four. "Please excuse Jimmy for not being in school yesterday. His father is gone, and I could not get him ready because I was in bed with a doctor." I think that's not what she meant to say. One of my two favorites. "Please excuse Robert for being, period. It was his father's fault." And last but not least, "Please excuse Jennifer for missing school yesterday. We forgot to get the Sunday paper off the porch. And when we found it on Monday, we thought it was Sunday." All right. There's a family that need a different way of gaining information. My family pray for my conversion. I have people with whom I've lived that say I'm Satan-possessed because of my belief system. And I recognize two things. One, I use an entirely different epistemological base than they do. So there's, and this has changed for me, there's a more loving, empathic response. But people of faith, I apply that to myself. Hear it this way and meditate upon this for a few months. I am convinced at age 50, absolutely convinced, there's something that I know for sure, maybe even that, and it's absolutely wrong. My pilgrimage in 50 years, if it's taught me anything, has taught me there's something that with passion, with conviction, with vehemence, this is the way the universe is, and it's absolutely false. The joy is, I don't know what it is. Maybe 51, maybe 71, if I live that long, I'll find out.